Okay, let's unpack this. You know that little flicker of temptation everyone feels sometimes? Imagine walking past an unlocked car. Keys, right there in the ignition.
Oh, yeah.
Today, we're diving into a real case, People v. Watson, that put a spotlight on a very similar scenario created by the police.
Right.
We're going to figure out if they just presented an opportunity or if they actually crossed the line into what the law calls entrapment.
Exactly. And People v. Watson, this was back in 2000. The California Supreme Court really grappled with that tricky question of when a police sting operation goes too far. For you listening, understanding this case is key to grasping the legal boundaries that law enforcement has to respect.
Yeah, and how courts look at it.
Precisely. And how the courts analyze those situations. We'll break down the facts, the specific legal test that was applied, and why this case is still so relevant today.
So picture this, Bakersfield, California. The police decide to stage, like, a fake arrest. And part of this setup involves leaving an unlocked, unmarked police car, a genuine classic, a 1980 Chevrolet Monte Carlo, just sitting in a parking lot.
Wow, a Monte Carlo.
Yeah, with the keys in the ignition. It's almost like they're saying, go ahead, take it.
Right, and someone did. About 2 hours later, this guy, Trey Edward Watson, hears about this apparently abandoned car from his niece.
From his knees. Okay.
Yeah, so he goes to check it out, gets in, drives it away, and bam, immediately arrested. He even admitted later that he just, wanted to drive it around. What's fascinating here is how that simple act led to such a complex legal battle.
Right, because the first attempt to convict him, it didn't go smoothly at all.
No.
The first trial ended with the jury unable to agree a mistrial, and that was after they were given instructions on the law of entrapment.
Right, so entrapment was definitely on the table initially, but the second trial, well, that took a different path. The judge decided not to instruct the jury on entrapment.
Okay, big difference.
Huge difference. And this time, Watson was found guilty. But then the California Court of Appeals stepped in and reversed that conviction.
Why? What was their reasoning?
Their thinking was that the police conduct, leaving the car like that, had made it unusually attractive to steal. That specific phrase is important.
Unusually attractive. Okay.
And that's what pushed the case up to the California Supreme Court. They had to review it.
Which brings us right to the central legal puzzle. Was the trial court correct in that second trial to just not even tell the jury about entrapment as a possible defense?
Exactly.
Another way, like, at what point does offering what looks like an easy opportunity become the state improperly inducing someone to commit a crime?
That's precisely the core of the issue, and it's where the Barraza test becomes crucial. This is the specific legal framework California courts use to figure out if entrapment actually happened.
Okay, the Barraza test.
It has two really important parts, or prongs, as lawyers like to say. The first asks, did the police conduct generate in a normally law-abiding person a motive for the crime other than just the usual criminal intent? So basically, did the police do something that would push someone who isn't typically a criminal towards committing this offense for some reason beyond just wanting to break the law?
Okay, that makes sense. Pushing someone who wouldn't normally do it. What's the second part?
The second prong looks at whether the police conduct made committing the crime unusually attractive to a normally law-abiding person.
Back to unusually attractive.
Exactly. Think about things like a guarantee that they wouldn't get caught, or maybe offering a reward or benefit that's way out of proportion. For you listening, what this test really boils down to is whether the police essentially created a criminal where one wouldn't normally exist, rather than just catching someone already inclined to break the law.
That phrase, normally law-abiding person, is interesting, though. How do the courts actually define that? Seems pretty subjective.
That's a really insightful question. And yeah, you're right, it's not like there's a rigid checklist. Instead, the courts look at the likely impact of the police conduct on a hypothetical person, someone who generally obeys the law and doesn't already have the intent to commit that specific crime.
So it's about the police actions, not necessarily the person's history.
It's primarily about the tendency of the police actions to induce someone who isn't already criminally inclined. The focus shifts to the government's conduct.
Okay, so how did the California Supreme Court apply these two parts of the Barraza test to Watson and the Monte Carlo situation.
Well, that's the heart of their decision. The court really emphasized that the police action here, leaving the unlocked car with the keys, was a general opportunity. It was available to anyone walking by.
Right. It wasn't like they called Watts in and said, hey, free car.
Exactly. It wasn't specifically targeted at him or any other particular individual. It was just there in the parking lot.
And that lack of specific targeting, that was a big deal for the court.
Absolutely. The majority reasoned, and here's a key quote, basically, opportunistic thieves aren't normally law-abiding.
Ouch.
Yeah. Their fundamental argument was that simply providing an opportunity without any kind of personalized pressure or specific promises from the police directed at one person just doesn't add up to entrapment under that Barraza test.
So mere temptation isn't enough.
Essentially, yes. They concluded that the mere temptation wasn't enough to sway someone who is truly normally law-abiding into stealing a car.
But it wasn't unanimous. I remember hearing there's a concurring opinion that brought up the different angles.
You're right. Justice Chin wrote the majority opinion. And like we said, he made it pretty clear that people who jump on such easy opportunities aren't really who the entrapment defense is designed to protect.
Okay.
He clarified that these kinds of general sting operations are usually okay as long as they offer an opportunity broadly to the public and don't involve what he called personal pressure or, you know, targeting someone with coercive tactics.
And then there was Justice Mosk. He agreed with the outcome. Legally speaking.
Right. He agreed that under the law, as it stood with the Barraza test, this wasn't entrapment.
Right.
But he raised some really important philosophical and ethical concerns, didn't he?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
His core argument was about the role of the police. He felt their primary mission should be to prevent crime, not to, well, create or facilitate it, even if the goal is catching someone.
Makes sense. Like, should they be locking cars, not unlocking them?
Precisely. And he had a very direct quote that really captured that idea.
What was it?
Justice Mosk stated very clearly, police should prevent crimes, not make them easier to commit.
Wow. Pretty blunt.
Very. He expressed a strong preference for law enforcement focusing on strategies that make crime harder to commit, rather than setting up these tempting scenarios just to catch people who might fall for them. It really adds that ethical dimension to the whole discussion.
So taking all that in, what are the main practical implications of the Watson case for how police can, you know, conduct these types of operations today?
Well, the Watson decision really reinforces that sting operations are generally going to be legally okay as long as they avoid directly and specifically inducing or pressuring a particular individual.
So general opportunities are fine, targeting isn't.
Broadly speaking, yes. Tactics that offer an opportunity to the public at large, like the bait car here, are far less likely to be seen as entrapment. The crucial factor seems to be that the opportunity is just out there, not something specifically designed and aimed to overcome one person's will.
And for someone who might find themselves charged in a similar situation, what's the key takeaway about trying to use entrapment as a defense after this ruling?
The critical thing to understand is that legal distinction between just being presented with an easy opportunity and actual entrapment.
Right.
According to Watson and Barraza, entrapment needs more than just temptation. It usually involves some kind of active, personalized inducement by the police where they essentially persuade or pressure a specific individual into committing a crime they wouldn't have otherwise.
It's also interesting that the focus is so much on what the police did, right? Not just on whether the defendant might have done something bad anyway.
That's a really important point to underscore, yes. The entrapment defense in California really hinges on the conduct of law enforcement. The main question isn't just, was this person predisposed to commit this crime?
Uh-huh.
Instead, the courts look at whether the police actions themselves were likely to induce a normally law-abiding person to commit that offense. The focus is on the government's behavior.
So it really does come back to that ongoing balancing act, doesn't it? The need for police to fight crime versus the ethical lines they shouldn't cross.
Exactly.
When does creating temptation become, like, unfair coercion?
Precisely. And the Watson case gives us a legal framework for where that line is generally drawn in California. But as Justice Mosk's concurrence really highlights, there are also these important ethical and societal questions about the police's role that go beyond just the strict legal definition.
Okay, so let's try to sum it up. The People v. Watson case basically clarifies that in California, just creating an opportunity for a crime without targeting someone specific or using coercive tactics probably is an entrapment.
Right.
The key question for the courts is whether the police conduct was likely to induce a normally law-abiding person to commit the crime.
That's a concise and accurate summary, and it really leaves you, the listener, with an important question to mull over. Thinking about Justice Mosk's ethical points, where do you believe the line should be drawn between just offering an opportunity and maybe unacceptable encouragement by the police? And how does this whole concept of a normally law-abiding person actually influence your own understanding of justice and, well, the proper limits of police conduct? It's definitely complex.
No easy answers there. Definitely something to think about.